I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Today is the Transgender Day of Remembrance, with memorials and vigils being held across the country to remember trans people who've been murdered. Last month, Keisha Jenkins became the second trans woman killed in Philadelphia this year. Before Jenkins' murder was made public, the Philadelphia Police Department worked with a group of LGBT advocates to ensure they were correctly identifying her. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that this collaboration was years in the making.
27-year-old Kyra Cordova was murdered in September 2012. She was shot in the head, and police found her body near a wooded area in northeast Philadelphia. Her purse had been stolen, along with her ID and her cell phone. It took several days before the police identified Cordova. Her mother, Dawn Mayer, didn't know her daughter was dead until a week later. Mayer blames the police department for misidentifying her. Early news reports described Cordova as a man dressed as a woman.
That was insulting.
Mayer believes that if the police department had described her to the media as a woman and mentioned the large tattoo of a phoenix on her back, they might have identified her sooner. She also wouldn't feel so guilty 3 years later.
Knowing that my baby laid in the morgue for a week with no one to come and claim her was devastating to me. Devastating. Because that just says you don't care.
At the time, Nellie Fitzpatrick was a prosecutor with the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. She was also the office's LGBT liaison. When she heard the report of a dead man dressed as a woman, Fitzpatrick skipped chain of command and called up the homicide unit herself. She told the officer who picked up the phone that the department was misidentifying the victim.
This isn't who the person is. So if you're looking for somebody who's murdered this woman, you're not going to find them by talking about her in the way that you are.
That did not go over well with her superiors. Fitzpatrick, now the director of the mayor's Office of LGBT Affairs, says she learned that lesson.
But it was very painful to see the whole community grieving for somebody that had been murdered so violently, so young, and then the continuous and vicarious trauma of the misreporting and the misinformation and the lack of respect and dignity that this person was shown at the end of their life. It was heartbreaking.
After Cordova's murder, Fitzpatrick worked with the police department to develop a directive. That's cop speak for a set of rules officers must follow when working with the LGBT community. Today, Philadelphia police officers are required to use transgendered people's preferred names and pronouns. Transgender advocates like Deja Lynn Alvarez say it's starting to help.
With each death, we seem to take another step forward. We seem to progress. The way that I like to put it is that it's being made, unfortunately, off of the deaths of my sisters.
Now, Alvarez is one of the first people the department calls when a transgender person is victimized. She's also a member of the police LGBT liaison committee. That's huge when you consider Alvarez sued the police department back in the mid-90s. Recently, she took me back to the corner of 13th and Locust Streets in Philadelphia's Gayborhood. That's where Alvarez and a friend were trying to hail a cab one night 20 years ago. They were careful to stand a block away from the stroll. That's where sex workers looked for business. It didn't help.
When the officer pulled up first, and that's where it started. He got on the loudspeaker and said, "I told you effing animals to go the F home," and it escalated. I don't know what it was about that moment, but I just couldn't take it anymore. After years and years and years of suffering the abuse, emotional, physical, mental, from the police officers, that was it.
Eventually, Alvarez settled with the city. One of the terms was that police officers who work the neighborhood receive sensitivity training. Today, she's one of the people who trains all new police cadets. Alvarez feels safe when she sees police officers in Philadelphia, but she knows a lot of other transgender people who don't. Identifying the dead by the way they lived is one step, she says. But it's time for a culture change within the police department. Deputy Commissioner Kevin Bethel is the police department's LGBT liaison. He says that change is happening, albeit slowly.
We have men and women in our workforce now who get it, who come to this process understanding that we have a responsibility to serve our entire community. If you're a police officer today who sits out there who hates someone sheerly because of how they identify themselves or how they look, then you need to go look for another job.
Bethel is retiring at the end of the year, but he's confident his successor will keep building on the relationships he's made with the transgender community. Kyra Cordova's murder remains unsolved. Her mother, Dawn Mayer, takes some solace that her daughter's death has made a difference in other cases, like Keisha Jenkins, who was beaten and shot in the back during a robbery last month.
Keisha, they were able to identify her in an hour, which is fantastic. But I wish I had known in an hour.
Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Public attitudes around accepting refugees from Syria have hardened in the week since the Paris attacks. Let's look at the numbers with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, the slew of politicians now just saying no to the Obama administration's previously announced intent to relocate 10,000 Syrian refugees must feel that they have the strong support of their constituents.
Well, we're waiting to see what the reaction is going to be when we and others poll since the Paris attacks. There have been no polls, to my knowledge, since that point. But we did have a couple of polls that were done prior to the Paris attacks, but after Obama had announced his policy of allowing 10,000 Syrian refugees to come to this country. And they were mixed. One poll done by Pew Research was fairly mild in its wording. It says this policy has been announced. It didn't mention a number of refugees, and 51% of Americans said they supported it. But a Quinnipiac poll very specifically said, would you favor or oppose a policy to allow 10,000 refugees from Syria to come to this country? And they found majority opposition. But again, we'll wait and see over the next several weeks whether or not attitudes change as a result of what we've seen occur in France in the last week or so.
Let's put this in some historical context. And specifically, for starters, was Gallup polling when those fleeing Nazi Europe sought refuge in the United States?
Yeah, it's really fascinating, Dave. I did a review of all the times that Gallup over history, going back to the 1930s, has asked about refugees coming into this country, usually as a result of the kinds of troubles that we're seeing in Syria. Yes, back in 1939, Gallup asked questions about refugees from Germany coming to this country, and it was children from Germany, fleeing Germany is how it was specified. Children were in there, and 67% of Americans said no. And this was 1939 after Kristallnacht, which you remember occurred in the fall of 1939 and was a major incident where it became clear that Jews were going to be persecuted and they began to try to immigrate in large numbers. And yet, even after all that news coverage, we had a significant majority of Americans who said no to the idea of welcoming children who were fleeing from Germany at that point. And since then, we've asked it about other situations. After World War II, we said, what about refugees? And we had a majority of Americans, or at least a plurality, who said no. They didn't want refugees from Europe after World War II coming to this country, which was quite interesting. And we asked it about Hungarian refugees in the 1950s, after the uprising there was put down forcefully by Soviet forces. Maybe as many as 30,000 Hungarians were killed in that. But even then, we had a majority of Americans who said no to the idea of letting Hungarian refugees come to this country. We've had some more questions since then. But generally speaking, Dave, my point is Americans have been very wary of the idea of allowing refugees to come into this country, even when they're fleeing obvious persecution and oppression in other places around the world.
Frank, prior to Paris, was terrorism rising as a concern for Americans?
We had mixed signals on that, and we had very few Americans who explicitly, and this is in early November, November 4 to 8th, our most recent update of our most important problem question, who mentioned terrorism as the most important problem facing this country, just 3% to be specific. But as I look back over this year, we have asked several different questions about terrorism, and we had seen prior to these Paris attacks an increasing evidence of concern on the part of the American public. Are you worried about a future terrorist attack? 51% of Americans said yes, and that was up significantly earlier this year. 49% of Americans said they were worried that they or a member of their family would be a victim of a terrorist attack, and that was also up earlier this year. And although confidence in the U.S. government to protect us from terrorism is high, 67%, that's actually down. It had been up in the 70s and even 80% earlier. So earlier this year, and this is the key point, we were already seeing some increasing signs of concern on the part of the American public, probably as a result of all the visibility and publicity given to ISIS and what's going on with the Islamic State in Europe and in the Middle East.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Turning to this evening's headlines, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says he was not threatened by a passenger on board a flight from San Francisco to Boston. A passenger was removed for an unknown reason, and several news outlets initially reported the passenger threatened Christie, resulting in his removal from the plane and a five-hour delay. Meanwhile, a Philadelphia man says he feels humiliated after he was briefly stopped from boarding a flight from Chicago when another passenger overheard him speaking in Arabic, making him uncomfortable. Pizza shop owner Mar Kali said today he had never experienced discrimination before this week's incident at Midway International. Pennsylvania's unemployment rate showed signs of improvement last month as employers added jobs. The State Department of Labor and Industry disclosed today the jobless rate slid 0.2 percentage point to 5.1% in October, though it still remains above Pennsylvania's post-recession low of 5% attained last December. 46 degrees, mostly clear skies at 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Turning partly cloudy overnight, falling back to a frosty 37 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, Saturday's high 52. Sunday, enjoy intervals of sun and clouds, high around 50 degrees. Still ahead.
It takes a real small army of people to really push it to make it go with some financial backing.
A world-class music summit makes its way to a tiny school in Bucks County. Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
Virtua proudly supports WHYY. This is the time of year to sign up for health insurance. When choosing a health insurance plan, it's important to know whether your doctor or hospital is included. If you want to use a Virtua physician, hospital, or outpatient service, you can find out if Virtua is in the plan you're considering by calling 888-VIRTUA-3. That's 888-VIRTUA-3. Virtua proudly supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra has partnered with a small Christian university in the suburbs to create an annual music education summit. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that violinist David Kim wants to keep it small and spiritual.
The newly minted David Kim Orchestral Institute launched this week with a prayer.
Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this day.
That is David Kim. He's a concertmaster for the Philadelphia Orchestra and an in-demand soloist around the world. For years, he's been thinking about opening a school like this.
We've kind of explored the subject of starting schools in the Bay Area, France, Japan, in Korea, and yet none of them have panned out. It takes a real small army of people to really push it to make it go with some financial backing.
It finally happened at a tiny Christian school in Langhorne, Pennsylvania. Cairn University has a student body of 1,100. Its music department has just 50, none of whom qualified for this institute. Violin players from around the world auditioned. 16 were accepted to study for 5 days with classical luminaries like David Chan of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, Richard Amoroso, first violinist with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and, of course, David Kim himself.
It's just important that what we're providing is done in a very humble manner, and I think humility comes in great quantities right here at Cairn.
While many of the attendees are Christian, some are not. Quan Zhang from China, now studying at Jacobs Music School in Indiana, came strictly for the professional training. Zhang performed an excerpt from Schubert's Symphony No. 2.
Well, you're brave. If somebody gave me a bag of excerpts, that's not the one I would pick. But thank you for volunteering to do it.
That is David Chan. He's a concertmaster of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. Chan's beliefs, as a Christian, are integral to his music, but his critique of Zhang was purely technical.
So I know if I play where the three notes are faster than the next 16 notes, then I know that I've done it wrong.
Most of the attendees at the Institute are religious, like Caleb Cox of Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah, I'm going to be playing the prelude to Bach's second cello suite in D minor.
And Maria Arrua from Paraguay, but now studying for her doctorate at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's Catholic.
I think music is very spiritual, and we don't always get to make that relationship when we are at school. I always put it together myself. But now this is a chance to put it together as a group.
David Kim takes the long view when asked about maintaining his spirituality in the sometimes cutthroat classical music industry. Now 52, he has had his ups and downs as a performer, but just before he sets foot on stage, he says his belief evens the keel.
Once you can release that insecurity and just surrender, then your body knows how to already play the violin. Why do we spend all these thousands of hours doing exercises, practice? It's so that eventually we can just let our bodies do its thing.
On Sunday, the last day of the Institute, students will be joined by members of the Philadelphia Orchestra for a final concert open to the public at Cairn University. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The history of Philadelphia is closely tied to its waterways, as settlement began along the Delaware River in the 17th century and then proceeded westward. Let's follow the winds in the river with Philadelphia Water Department historian Adam Levine. Adam, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
It's nice to be here, Dave.
Adam, let's focus on that westward point in the city, the Copps Creek watershed, apparently home to the state's first water mill.
Yes, it was a Swedish mill. I think it was 1635 or 1636. They were grinding flour. It was right near where the Bluebell Tavern is now at 73rd Street and Woodland Avenue.
Suffice to say that most people now wouldn't recognize Philadelphia as it existed back then. Tell us about the proliferation of watersheds and waterways.
Well, there were many more streams in the city than you would see today. Cobbs Creek still exists as the western boundary, but there were a lot of little tributaries to Cobbs Creek and to other, like the Schuylkill River and things, that were put into sewers over the years.
How many were there originally?
There could have been up to 400 miles of streams, including little streams coming out of springs and small tributaries, a lot of which never were named. Now there's probably less than 100 miles, if that.
All of vital importance in centuries past as the United States became increasingly, and our region became increasingly industrialized. Talk about the variety of uses they were put to.
Some of the uses would have been for providing water power for sawmills, for grist mills, which ground flour. Then as the textile industry came here in the beginning of the first half of the 19th century, the water would have been used, diverted out of the creeks and used for bleaching and dyeing. And of course, that polluted water was then dumped right back in the creek right below the mills.
When was the beginning of the awareness of the deleterious effects that the industrialization was having on these watersheds?
Probably as early as the 1820s, if you go back to the Schuylkill River being the water source of the city, where the Fairmount Waterworks was, and before the Fairmount Waterworks and other waterworks, starting in 1801, would have been taking water out of the Schuylkill River. So they knew that they didn't want to be polluting the river. When the streams are running purple or green or black or whatever color the dyes are being dumped into it, or when the streams are so foully smelling that nobody wants to get near them, it becomes apparent even to people who don't understand bacteria, don't understand the transmission of disease, that this is not a good situation.
Fast forward to the 20th century and talk about development then.
By the 20th century, we can focus on Cobbs Creek. The beginning of the 20th century, the development has just started reaching out to the western edge of the city. The Market Frankford line was built in the first, by 1910 or 1915, it had reached Upper Darby. And the Mill Creek Sewer, which was a big creek that was cut diagonally across West Philadelphia, had been the Mill Creek had been put underground into a sewer. And so those two things spurred the development of West Philadelphia westward. If you look at some of the early maps showing where the streets were supposed to go, they actually had streets drawn right out over the edge of Cobbs Creek, as if they were going to fill in Cobbs Creek as well and put that in a pipe. They of course, never did. But the city engineers were very aggressive laying out the city streets, mainly because development, as it does today, brings in tax revenue.
There are so many ways to view the history of Philadelphia or any city. Some do it primarily through its architecture, other through its history in terms of politics or strife. Do you inordinately see the city through its waterways?
I do. The city developed along the riverfronts at first, the Delaware riverfront, and the first mill was built along Cobbs Creek, the first mill in Pennsylvania, even before William Penn got here. Industry was sited along the streams. So, yeah, I do see the city through its waterways, and not just through the living waterways, but through the sewers, because the sewers follow the natural landscape, the original topography of the city. And it's a sad but fascinating way to look at the city. I've always been one who's for the underdogs. And these poor streams in urban areas are very much abused, even to this day.
Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Adam Levine is the historian for Philadelphia Water Department. We'll give a talk about the history of the Cobbs Creek neighborhood and watershed on Monday at the Cobbs Creek branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Finally this evening, a new app is up and running in Burlington County, but don't expect to use it to kill time in waiting rooms. PulsePoint is an app developed by the Virtua Health System. It will alert CPR-trained personnel within 15 minutes of a person in cardiac arrest. After a 911 call is placed, those with the app will be notified so that they may provide basic CPR until an ambulance arrives on scene. And for now, Virtua says the app is limited to Burlington County with hopes to expand in the near future. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from our intern, Kevin Rowley. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting vice president of News and Civic Dialogue. Find us on iNews or listen at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The University of the Arts supports WHYY and is hosting a graduate open house Saturday, November 21st. It's an opportunity to learn about UArts master's programs in studio art, museum studies, art and music education, design for social impact, product design, jazz studies, theater, educational program design, and educational technology. UArts Graduate Open House, Saturday, November 21st, 2 to 5 p.m., 211 South Broad Street. Details at uarts.edu.
Crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely.
This week, Willie Nelson became the first country artist to receive the Gershwin Prize for American Popular Song from the Library of Congress. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interviews with him in which he sang a few of his songs. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
I knew.
The Mequon School supports WHYY. Located on a wooded campus near Northwest Philadelphia, the Mequon School is a progressive elementary school for children ages 3 to 12. At the Mequon School, children's curiosity and initiative are an integral part of their education. Purposeful instruction is combined with opportunities for children to explore, discover, dream, and create. A family open house is November 21st at 1:30. Info at mequon.org/open.